The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is William Ammerman, author of The Invisible Brand, Marketing in the Age of Automation, Big Data, and Machine Learning. And you are listening to Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails.
Hello and welcome to this hopefully short-lived series that will be airing in addition to the weekly Marketing Book podcast interviews. I'm your host, Douglas Burdett, and my goal during this unusual time is to reconnect you with past guests on the Marketing Book podcast, share some ideas and inspiration, and maybe a much-needed laugh or two. I've interviewed over 200 authors on the show, and my plan is to continue this series until I either run out of authors or quarantine, whichever comes first. A word of warning, the host and guest may very likely be drinking cocktails during these conversations. I mean, come on, they are recorded during the cocktail hour. To find the show notes for each episode with pictures of each guest and links mentioned in their conversation, visit marketingbookcocktails.com. marketingbookcocktails.com. See what I did there? And if you'd like to join the conversation, email a voice recording to me at douglas@salesartillery.com, and I'll try to include it in a future episode. I'd love to hear from you. Otherwise, connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat. William Ammerman, welcome to Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails. How are you?
I'm great. I've got my cocktail and I'm ready.
Well, what is your cocktail?
This is The Last Word. Seems very literary, and it's an old Prohibition cocktail made from equal parts of gin, maraschino liqueur, chartreuse, and lime juice. And I will say that chartreuse is a vicious substance. It is 55% alcohol, so 110 proof, green, and herbal, and these monks make this stuff, and it's got quite a punch. So when you mix it all together, you get this very complex drink that balances sweetness and sour with a lot of herbal notes, and it's extremely flavorful. It's quite a puzzle for your palate. It's like a Rubik's cube for your taste buds. It's delicious.
Is there any chance we could get the recipe and put it on this episode's show notes at marketingbookcocktails.com?
Absolutely.
You looked like quite the mixologist. Before we started recording, I saw this really rather well-stocked liquor cabinet in your room there. And then I remembered, oh, that's right, he's a Michigan grad.
And I bartended in Los Angeles for a little while right out of college. So it's not a coincidence that I keep a well-stocked liquor cabinet.
So bartending in LA after graduating from Michigan, was that, from an alcoholic standpoint, was that sort of a step down?
That was right. That was not quite to the standards that we had in Ann Arbor, but still fun.
Well, you should know that I have interviewed 4 authors on the Marketing Week podcast who are Michigan grads, and I was so excited about this, and all 4 books were absolutely terrific, and I introduced all 4 of you, and I hope that you guys have kept in touch. It's you, Tracy Eiler, co-author of Aligned to Achieve, and Ethan Butte, co-author of Humanize Your Business, and Louis Gadima, author of Bullseye Marketing. So, and even in Authors in Quarantine, all 4 of you have showed up. It seems to be, you all seem to be very reliable in that regard.
I've got a son who is at the University of Michigan right now.
Oh.
And they are obviously, you know, doing remote distance learning. And so they've recreated the Michigan logo as the University of Michigan at Phoenix. for the Phoenix distance learning company.
Yes. Now let's not be hating on those Phoenix folks. But
it's pretty funny though. I you know, when you're paying $70,000 a year to go to an online learning company, it's kind of a little strange to be sure.
And that's why I've heard that next year, could, who knows what's going to happen, but Next year could be the mother of all gap years, because a lot of families are saying, wait a minute, we're going to pay $70,000. Is that for the full academic year?
Well, that's including travel and, you know, if you add in all your expenses.
And alcohol, right.
Right, and your alcohol.
We don't want to pay that for you to sit there at a computer. So there's a lot of people that are rethinking things. So, you know, healthcare and education are just two amongst the many categories that this whole pandemic is making people sort of rethink. Now, before we go much further, last Friday, I published episode 283. You were on episode 246 in September 2019. So for new listeners, tell them who you are and what you do.
So I wrote a book about marketing in the age of artificial intelligence. And professionally, I've spent two decades as a marketer and a digital advertising executive. I've got a lot of experience managing billions with a B of ad impressions that are delivered through digital devices like your mobile phone. And I've done postgraduate work in artificial intelligence at MIT. And I wrote the book to really help people understand what is changing about the world of marketing and conversely how the world of marketing is changing us. We're living through a period of this pandemic, and of course it's causing us to rethink things like telemedicine and distance learning. And I actually address those topics in the book, because these technologies that are driven by machine learning, by natural language processing, increasingly afford us the opportunity to interact with machines, to have those machines collect data about us, and then use that data and interpret that data to find patterns in aggregate. And that's very useful in a number of areas. Of course, we're all talking about disease control right now. Think about the possibility for tracking the movement of a disease by aggregating data about people's purchasing behaviors. In the book, I tell this anecdote. It was originally published in the New Yorker magazine, and the Target stores had set out to figure out when a woman was pregnant based on the data in their system, and they could actually determine when a woman was pregnant based on changes in her shopping patterns, and they were successful at it. It's kind of an amazing thing. Well, if you extrapolate, you can do the same thing with mass patterns of purchasing behavior across populations, and if you see changes, you know, I don't know what those changes might be, but you can imagine, you know, suddenly there's a run on thermometers, or, you know, vitamins. Everybody runs out and buys vitamins or something. You could start to see that you could potentially apply artificial intelligence to track the movement and emergence of disease hotspots. And that's actually what a lot of people have been working very hard on, is applying this technology to track COVID and figure out, you know, where it's moving, where it's emerging, where it's shrinking, and, you know, where we flatten the curve and where it's, an increasing threat to the population. So kind of prescient and fun to have written the book in time to, you know, put it out there where people could start to understand how this technology is working.
But let's get back to William Ammerman.
Enough about the book.
Let's talk about William Ammerman. Okay, your favorite movie is Blade Runner. What does that tell us about William Ammerman?
I like the cinema noir genre of science fiction. So if you look back at my favorite movies, that's top of the list. But I also like Casablanca, and I think that if you look at some of the movies that I enjoy watching more than once, you'll see a pattern of these kind of dark, sexy, very heavy atmospheric movies with lots of rich cinematography and great script writing. And that's kind of what I'm about in movies.
Well, and you could argue that in the 1940s or the 1950s, that really was the high point of cinema.
Yeah, people forget that Casablanca was actually produced during World War II, before we knew the ending. And And of course, you know, the ending of the movie Casablanca leaves us with, you know, the dead Nazi and the French lieutenant and Humphrey Bogart in partnership to send off the French resistance fighter to continue the war effort. And, you know, what's amazing about that is if you really put it into perspective, people didn't know how the war was going to end. People didn't know whether or not we were going to be victorious. And so when you appreciate that about Casablanca, it really, you know, kind of changes your perception of the movie. If the Nazis, of course, had won, they might have rounded up the usual suspects on their own in, you know, the people that had made that movie, hold them responsible for kind of anti-Nazi propaganda. So there's a bit of, you know, there's a bit of risk involved in making that movie at the time. I mean, I'm thrilled and glad that it was made, but I do appreciate the fact that the people that made that movie were gambling a little bit on history with their lives.
You know, I knew that, I think it was like 1943 and that when they made the movie, but I never made that connection that it still wasn't quite resolved. I mean, the Normandy invasion hadn't even happened yet.
Oh yeah. Before the Battle of the Bulge, before Normandy. I mean, it was up in the air and, you know, there was no sure thing about how that thing was going to end. And, you know, when you put it into that perspective, suddenly it changes changes your perspective on that movie significantly.
Interesting. So the Invisible Brand, please take us back, and this will delight our listeners in Scotland.
I'm rich and I'm dead sexy.
Tell us the derivation of the name of your book.
Well, Adam Smith, your Scottish connection there, wrote The Wealth of Nations back in 1776. And in that book, he identified this force in the market economy, the invisible hand. And the invisible hand, of course, is that force that says that people acting on their own for their own self-interest will produce value for society as a whole. And that, you know, has been the basis for Western economics as a science ever since. So he was the first economist and the first person to really formalize it as a science, as a course of study. And when I was writing the book, I still hadn't come up with a name, and I was discussing the fact that it was this kind of market force, and somebody actually said out loud, it's kind of like the invisible hand. And I thought, that's very clever. What marketing term rhymes with hand? And I thought, you know, the invisible advertiser, the invisible corporation, the invisible, and then, you know, it hit me between the eyes, the invisible brand, and that just stuck. And everybody seemed to like it, and we went with it.
Well, it certainly works. And I guess another way that would be much more clumsy and doesn't rhyme at all, but it's like a heat-seeking missile, either the invisible hand of economics or the invisible brand. So explain how this artificial intelligence and machine learning appears to be working invisibly.
Yeah, so we're used to brands that, you know, the big bullseye on the front of the Target store or the Coca-Cola can. But what's really happening in the world of branding is that brands are talking to us invisibly through persuasion. And in the book, I lay out an argument that there's really kind of four trends, and I'll lay them out very briefly. The first trend is, of course, that we are gathering huge amounts of personal data about individuals, and we're customizing the digital experience for that individual. You might see different sports data. If you went to, you know, a sports website, you follow different teams than I do, you're going to see those scores populate first.
And your Facebook feed is going to have things about why can't we beat Ohio State? Why was the last time 2011? I'm sorry, but I interrupted.
Yes. So I'm going to just ignore that and keep moving. So the challenge with the personalization of information is that people don't necessarily appreciate that what they're seeing is very different than what the next person is seeing. And so they're consuming information that puts them into a bit of a filter bubble where they're seeing things that are based on what they like and their interests and what keeps them engaged and coming back to the web. And other people are seeing different things. And in some cases, we're consuming information that is, you know, diametrically opposed. And so we wonder why we're so polarized. But anyway, personalization of information is the first trend. The second, if we look at persuasion, it has become a science. With digital data, we can actually A/B test different messages, and we can figure out which messages are working for which people to persuade them to purchase airplane tickets or to buy their masks online for protecting themselves against COVID. So we can test messages at a very formal level. And the third trend is that we're using machine learning to help us with both of those, with the personalizing sites and persuasion. And the fourth is that we're now talking to our machines using natural language processing. So to bring that all together, you're talking to a machine that is designed to learn how to persuade you using your own personalized data. And that's a game changer. We've never been at such a vulnerable state where the information that we provide to the digital environment is used almost against us to persuade us and change the way we think using our own, internal processes, our own psychology. And I brought that all together and I said, what is this? This is technology that uses our own psychology. So it's psychological technology. Put that together and you get psychotechnology. And so the book, is really about how artificial intelligence is allowing marketers to recapture some lost ground where the power swung in the favor of the consumer with the proliferation of the internet. Marketers are now gaining back a little bit of that power by being able to find tools in mathematics, artificial intelligence, to use that to persuade consumers, toward their own ends. And that's good in some cases if you're doing disease management and you're persuading populations to wear their masks and stay healthy and wash their hands. That's great. If you're using it to control populations and suppress freedoms and do totalitarianly naughty things, I think we can all agree that's dangerous. And so finding the right balance where we are allowing for the good while prohibiting the bad is part of what we talk about in the book. It's trying to figure out how do you strike that balance.
Yeah, I learned a lot about that. And I learned about, the example I think you had in there is of China was really amping up their tracking of everyone. Was it there?
Yes.
You talked about it's almost like a credit score now based on the government surveillance.
Yes, and it's
but it's more of a behavior scale.
I find it personally terrifying. It's probably the one thing in the world that keeps me up at night is the misuse and abuse of this technology. There's a for those fans out there who have ever watched the Black Mirror episode where they use social credit scores to deny the woman, a flight on a plane, and she goes to a wedding, and there's a bunch of bad things happen to her because her social credit score has been declined. It's kind of a pop culture reference, but in reality, that is in fact underway in communist China. And so the communist Chinese have created a social credit score in which they can actually give you points for behaviors that they find positive, and they can retract points or detract points when they find that your behaviors, if you're critical of the party, et cetera, are negative. And of course, the terrifying consequence of this is that individuals who are, have lower scores find themselves unable to purchase transportation. They find themselves denied opportunities for better housing and even access to, staple goods like toilet paper and soap and food. So the ability to apply social credit scores across a society, it becomes a currency. And so what you're seeing is a gradual shift away from a fiat currency in which individuals can keep dollars stashed under their mattress and spend them anonymously, towards a society in which the credit score becomes the currency and the government controls your finances down to, you know, the nth degree, and ultimately can control every aspect of your life.
Mm-hmm. So let's get back to William Ammerman. Now, where are you in quarantine? Is it at your home in North Carolina?
Yes, I've been in my home in North Carolina. I spent 10 weeks behaving very well.
And then you started talking to me.
And then gradually, I will readily admit, I started to venture forth. As things opened up, I actually went to a restaurant last week.
Did you have to sit outside?
It was outdoor seating, and we enjoyed ourselves, but we didn't stay terribly long. Stayed about an hour and left, long enough to have two beers and dinner. But it was the first meal that we had eaten out in 10 weeks. So we started into quarantine in early March and have just recently started to loosen up a little bit. But I've spent a lot of time in the house and I've put on 19 pounds. I call it the COVID-19. That has, you know, been a little depressing. I didn't realize that when you're bored out of your mind, you can eat an awful lot of Oreos. That's apparently a real thing.
But if you're just eating Oreos, you're not really doing it right. You got to deep fry them. I mean, come on. You're in North Carolina. Get with it, Cameron.
Yeah, they do sell those at the state fair. I admit that I have had a deep fried Snickers. That's as far as I can go. It was gross.
Yeah.
I mean, it was delicious, but it was gross. So don't do that.
I would love to have one before I die. And I say that because it would probably kill me.
Yeah, right. It's the last drop of cholesterol poisoning that your body can handle.
That's right. So did suddenly a lot of your plans have to change? Did you have to cancel trips or anything like that?
Yes. So I had a European tour for my book that got canceled. I was very unhappy about that. We had five countries, 10 cities over a course of 2 weeks, and we were traveling to universities. I have had to substitute that for volunteer guest lectures at places like UNC Chapel Hill. And these are online lectures where I've been providing guest lectures to students who are also in quarantine. But I've done them at Auburn University. I've done them at Long Island University, at Michigan State. I even did one at
Michigan State. Wow. Did they know that you were a Michigan grad?
I didn't emphasize that.
Okay.
Bucharest ASE, which is the Academy of Science, Economic Sciences in Bucharest, which is the top business school in Romania. So it's been a real great experience at some level, but I did miss out on the opportunity to travel around Europe for a few weeks with some academics and visit a lot of universities. So I'm hoping that at some time in the future, we can resurrect that tour, which was scheduled for April. But it was something that I actually lost out on, and I was quite disappointed that that didn't happen.
When do you think you might be able to do it? Like in another year or two?
Boy, if I had a crystal ball, I'd tell you, but it's hard.
If you had a crystal ball, you wouldn't be talking to me. That's
for sure. possibly next April. I think springtime in Europe is beautiful. And, you know, being able to travel around in April in Europe would be ideal. And perhaps, you know, if we get this COVID thing under control, it would be safe and people would be back out attending lectures in person. But I think there's going to be a lot of things that are unknowns that we have to resolve between now and then.
Well, when all this happened, was there anything that really, I guess, either surprised you or perhaps inspired you?
Oh, I think that it's been a little... stressful for everybody. And I think that that's showing. I think society is frayed around the edges. I noted somewhat humorously last week that a tweet went viral when the SpaceX capsule went off. Somebody tweeted out, "Congratulations to the astronauts who left Earth today. Good choice."
I saw that.
And I have to say, you know, when I read that, I thought, boy, that's true. And I'm feeling nostalgic for, you know, global warming. When all we had to worry about was melting polar ice caps, that was, you know, something that, really struck home with me that, you know, of all the things that we used to worry about, you know, things have been replaced by much more stressful and urgent and serious and day to day. And, you know, it's just one thing compounding another. And I think a lot of people are experiencing this kind of, COVID cabin fever, if you will.
Well, let me ask you a question that I'm sure at least a few people might be asking, because I've been asked this. We talk about, we talk about William Ameren, we talk about Blade Runner, we talk about artificial intelligence, machine learning, big data. Is all that really here? Sort of back to the old Palmolive TV commercials where Madge the manicurist was explaining that somebody was already soaking in it when she was doing their nails. How is AI and machine learning and all that? I mean, how is it being used now in marketing?
Well, I think one of the most obvious that is current and, you know, in the present tense is supply chain management. There's been an absolutely global supply chain disruption. And supply chain management that is powered by artificial intelligence is how you are starting to get toilet paper and masks and hand sanitizer back into your grocery store. And balancing supply chains across an entire planet is something that machines are better adept at doing than humans. And so, you know, one example is if you used hand sanitizer today, that was probably a function of machine learning, natural language processing, and artificial intelligence at work in the supply chain. So that would be a really quick example where you are already soaking in it, right? Your hands are literally rubbing hand sanitizer on your hands that, moved to your house and became part of your possessions as a result of some recent revolutionary changes in supply chain management.
And so when I log into Amazon and it says, "Welcome back, Douglas, here are some marketing books for you," is that it at work too?
Absolutely. You know, the world of the algorithm where, you know, people like you read this book or people who liked this song also liked this song. You know, we're soaking up recommendations from our digital devices, and the recommendations that we're being given are delivered to us very purposefully. You know, if we look at a list of 10 songs that you listen to, we can get your age within about a year. And that's extraordinary. When you start to think about the fact that the music you listen to identifies your age that precisely, it's startling. And, when we look at, someone's behavior Spotify or Pandora, we know a lot about who you are based on the music that you consume. So this is pervasive, and it's getting better and better. And we're being able to build individual profiles, psychological profiles about individuals based on the patterns of their media consumption, the patterns of their searches online, and even when you delve down into it, the types of things that they express an interest in identifies their personality.
So what is one thing that you hear all the time about, AI, machine learning, things, big data, things like that, that you would like to debunk? I mean, what's a myth that you or a misunderstanding you always hear that you would like to debunk most?
Well, there's a joke at the beginning of my book that artificial intelligence is, the art of making computers act like they do in the movies. And,
oh, right.
And so, that, yeah. You know, people frequently see things in the movies and somehow they assume that's already here. You know, are we already in a world in which we can, you know, the thought police can predict crime and, you know, can we reprogram the brain? And, you know, are we living in the age of Total Recall and the Matrix? And the reality is that we're not there yet. We are not at what we call general artificial intelligence. We are at kind of very specific cases where artificial intelligence is used in very specific and narrow applications. So the difference between general artificial intelligence is general artificial intelligence would be intelligence that rivals or surpasses human intelligence across the broad spectrum of, you know, what we think of as human intelligence. Narrow artificial intelligence is applying AI and machine learning to a very specific problem. I gave you an example just a minute ago of the global supply chain. So if you're trying to figure out how to balance the risk that petroleum will be choked off in the Persian Gulf and that we need to make certain that, you know, we can get petroleum from other sources on short notice, that's supply chain management at a macro level. And when you start to look at the complexity of that problem and making sure that you have sources for all of your different products and all the supplies that you need to manufacture your products, if there's a disruption in one place, that consumption can be redirected and that you have suppliers in other parts of the world that can provide it. And a computer is much better at figuring out that mess than an individual with a slide rule and, you know, a spreadsheet. So there are examples where narrow applications of artificial intelligence are hard at work today. But the thing I'd like to debunk, if there is something to debunk there, is that there's a machine out there that has general artificial intelligence, which, you know, kind of rivals human intelligence. That doesn't exist yet. It's been something that this kind of chimera that people have been, you know, chasing for, you know, decades. And I imagine that it will emerge in our lifetimes, but we're not quite there yet.
When your episode of on the Marketing Book podcast was played, I remember at the very beginning we played HAL.
Yeah.
From right. 2001.
Let me put it this way, Mr. Raymer. The 9000 series is the most reliable computer ever made. No 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information. We are all, by any practical definition of the words, foolproof and incapable of error.
And you were explaining that it's not there. That's not what you need to worry about. But William Aaron, one of my favorite comedians, is John Mulaney, and my kids love him too. Why did John Mulaney make an appearance in your book?
So Mulaney picked up on something which everybody has experienced, which are these CAPTCHA, these little computer programs that force you to identify stop signs or cars or bridges to prove that you're a human. And, you know, the joke that he, you know, really got well is that we spend a lot of time online convincing robots that we're not robots. And I think it's really funny because the truth is that in my lifetime, we've gone from thinking that, you know, that someday we might be able to, you know, kind of emulate human speech or human intelligence through computers, and that we've now reached the point where we have to actually prove that we're human to computers. And that's really ironic. And what's even more ironic is that it's easier to identify a human than to identify a robot online. If you think about it, you know, you just ask somebody a simple question like, you know, some very complex math problem that takes a human being, you know, 5 minutes to solve, and a computer can solve it in, you know, 5 milliseconds. You know, right there, you can, you know, a computer can figure out which, you know, who a human is. But can a human determine whether they're talking to a robot or a human, I think humans are at the disadvantage here, that it's going to be increasingly difficult for humans to tell who they're talking to. And and that's a big part of the invisible brand.
Because I'm not really a human. This is all an algorithm. I hate to break it to everyone after 5.5 years of doing this. No, I'm kidding. If it were an algorithm, it would be much better. But, you know, it's funny you say that about the conversations and the chat. The other day, well, actually today, I published the interview with your fellow Michigan grad, Tracy Eiler. And I was on her website, which is insideview.com, because they just released some research about sales and marketing alignment. But I was looking for something on their website, and a chat bot came up. And, you know, I've had various, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. You know, it's not because the chat bots are wrong. It's just the way they're set up. What they do at InsideView is they'll say, we're real humans waiting to answer your questions. And they show pictures of three of them. And I think it might even include their first names. And I saw that and I thought, oh, well, then maybe I will use the chatbot. I didn't need to. I found what I was looking for. But I just thought that was interesting, because we're already getting suspicious of the efficacy of some of this, you know, AI-driven chatbot stuff.
Right. And, you know, the reality is sometimes the chatbots get us to the right information faster than the humans do. So I think you might get a split verdict on whether you'd rather talk to a human or a chatbot. At some level, the chatbots might be better. If I was, you know, trying to figure out whether I have a broken bone, you know, we might reach a day when, and I think we're practically there, where image recognition is so good that you might actually trust the machine more than a radiologist to determine whether that's a break or a tumor or what that is. Because, of course, a machine can look at, you know, literally billions of examples that they can learn from, whereas a human might see only a few hundred thousand in their entire career. And you know, just the volume of data that the computer can learn from is vastly greater than what an individual human can. And that's powerful. So that's a positive application of this stuff. But it also should cause you to pause and think about, you know, who would I trust more with my, you know, diagnosis of my, you know, radiology exam, a machine or a human? And that it's I think that's troubling at some level, and it causes people to go, that's really interesting. I hadn't really thought about that.
Well, William Ammerman, if you could kind of dial it back on the radiologist, because my wife's a radiologist, and she's, you know, going to be working
still
for a few
more
years
than the machines this week. We got at least one more week.
Yeah, so don't be hating on my radiology folks. So at any rate, well, listen, what is, besides going out to this restaurant and eating outside and having two beers, what has William Ammerman been doing to keep himself entertained other than eating Oreos?
I have found myself reading a lot of classics that I should have read a long time ago. I just finished The Snows of Kilimanjaro. And I don't know why I was drawn to that. You know, maybe it was wanting to be in a very far off place and, you know, traveling very far away. But
like your trip to Europe?
Kilimanjaro, right, is about this writer named Harry, who's dying of gangrene. He's out stranded on a safari in Africa because their truck engine's burned out, and he scratched himself on a thorn, and he's sick, and he's literally, you know, stranded in the outback of Africa, dying of gangrene. And, you know, he makes a comment, which of course Hemingway writes about him, and he says he knew at least 20 good stories from out there, and he had never written one. And it, you know, the guy was kind of reminiscing about all of these adventures that he'd had in his life, but he had never committed any of them and written them down. And that made me nostalgic. It made me think of, you know, the great adventures that I've had in my lifetime that are worth sharing that I haven't written down. So it was inspiring at some level, depressing at others. And it was strangely prescient for the time, because here this guy is isolated, you know, with this illness and, you know, in a very destitute situation. And of course, no spoilers here. You know, if you haven't read Hemingway, I'm just going to give it away. But, you know, he dies there, and he dreams at the very end that he's, you know, flying off to the snowy peak of Mount Kilimanjaro. And, I think that's kind of, you know, both depressing, but also, you know, I think a lot of people are thinking about death, and I think a lot of people are, you know, pondering, you know, eternity. And this is a time of soul searching and deep reflection for a lot of people. So it was fascinating to read, you know, that particular Hemingway at this particular time. And I'm glad that I took the time to do that.
Well, we may have a copy of that at my house here somewhere. I know my wife went through sort of a Hemingway phase like about 2 years ago where she was rereading a lot of that. I'll have to see if I can pick that up. But it's true. I've heard of this all described different ways. But one of them is it's a great reset where everyone's rethinking what they're doing, what they had planned on doing. And they're rethinking even business, simple business decisions like why were we doing that? And how this has been an accelerant for changes that were probably needed to happen anyway.
Well, I mentioned one earlier, which is, you know, here I am a father paying tuition at a big league university where it's costing an absolute fortune to send my kid to Michigan. And, you know, I think that I'm not the only person that's questioning whether the $70,000 a year investment in sending kids off to college is worth it and whether there might not be a more efficient, practical, and even better means of education. And I think that, you know, the Band-Aid's been ripped off pretty hard recently where people are, you know, using distance learning and they're trying to figure out, you know, what are the shortcomings? What are the advantages? And I think it's going to be very difficult for universities to continue to justify their costs if we reach a point where online learning becomes an effective tool. And that's a game changer for a lot of big universities. And if you're in the higher education space, you're going to hate hearing me say that. But I even talked about that in the book because, you know, AI-powered distance learning is an opportunity to take advantage of the individual's learning style, figure out what makes that individual tick, how they learn, and then customize and remediate based on tactics that are more effective for them. So if they're a visual learner, if they learn by listening, or if they learn by doing, that you remediate and help them in their own kind of native learning style. And that's something that artificial intelligence would be very good at, which, you know, a professor standing in front of a classroom of 300 kids is not able to do.
There is a person I've been following a lot lately, listening to his podcast and reading. His name is Professor Scott Galloway. He teaches at NYU, and he's an investor and a tech guy, and he has been amplifying what you just said 10x. And he said, look, and I'm, you know, I teach at a college, but he's completely transparent saying, look, this is about to get disrupted like nobody's business. So William Ameren, you're not alone. You might want to listen to his new podcast. He talks about that and a few other things, but he's really trying to explain to everybody how that is going to be disrupted. And years from now, people are going to be talking about how this was, again, the term I used earlier, a big accelerant for change in not just academia, but any kind of learning. So, William, I am going to include on your show notes at marketingbookcocktails.com that clip of John Mulaney on YouTube. I've got it, and I've used it before. It's really funny, but it's the one where he's talking about the CAPTCHA boxes. And if possible, I'd like to include your recipe for the drink you're having right now. And otherwise, are there any other book ideas floating around in your head?
My problem isn't ever a lack of ideas. My problem is having too many and then not executing. It drives my wife crazy. I torment her with all of my brainstorms, and then she's always asking me 6 months later, what happened to that idea? So it would take us an entire another episode to go through all the things I would like to be writing
about.
Well,
let me go get another drink, and then I'll come right back. And we'll come back tomorrow, listener.
Right.
No, I'm the same way, William. I'm full of ideas as long as I don't have to implement them. So, yeah. I'm guilty too.
Yeah, all of us.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to catch up with you. And for you to join us here on this special limited time series of the Marketing Book Podcast called Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails. And I hope that you and your family and everyone in your world continues to stay safe and healthy.
I feel the same about you. Thank you. And you're doing a great job with this. I've actually followed the progression of your podcast, and I think this is absolutely a stroke of genius. So good work.